Welcome to DeltaCast, the podcast about the science of development and learning. DeltaCast is the official podcast of the Delta Center at the University of Iowa. This is our first episode. My name's Eric Jackson. I'm here with Mark Blumberg. What's up, Mark?
Hi, Eric. It's great to be here, of course.
I'm really excited about us starting this podcast.
Yeah, so am I. I mean, I think when you first approached me about the idea of having a podcast, I thought it was a great idea because, you know, as you put it, and as we started talking about it, it offered an opportunity for us to talk to people who were in the center and also people who visit us. We have access to a whole bunch of really interesting developmental scientists who come through Iowa City to visit the Delta Center and for other reasons. And they may give these great talks and colloquia and roundtables, but the podcast offers a really interesting opportunity to talk to them about things that they wouldn't normally talk about in an informal atmosphere, just about sort of what are the exciting things going on in their research, what sorts of things are they most concerned about in science, and things that, you know, most people wouldn't have an opportunity to talk to such people or to hear what they're thinking about on in a more formal environment.
That's really the idea, right? To invite some really smart people on and create this atmosphere where we get after what people talk about behind closed doors. I'm a postdoc who studies speech production and stuttering. You are a developmental behavioral neuroscientist. So we have different backgrounds. Certainly, you have much more experience than I do. But that's very representative of the Delta Center, isn't it?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, we have graduate students and postdocs and professors. We have people who work with humans and with non-human animals. We study different ages, but what we share is a common interest in trying to understand the processes of development, how things happen in real time, how you get from a fertilized egg to a developing adult, and all the things in between. So it's a very diverse group, but a very focused group in many ways.
And who better to have as our first guest on this inaugural episode than John Spencer?
John Spencer, the founding director of the center and a longtime friend and colleague. And it was great to have him here to sort of review the history of the center and talk about where things are going.
Welcome to DeltaCast, everybody. I'm Eric Jackson, here with Mark Blumberg, and special guest, John Spencer, who is back in Iowa City.
Hi, Eric.
Is it nice to be back, John?
It's surreal to be back.
So you guys go way back, right?
We go way back to the early 90s at Indiana University,
yeah. When
I was a young postdoc, and John was a young graduate student.
A younger graduate student.
And he found his way
Point
here.
Point of emphasis.
Yes.
Younger.
Younger.
Yeah.
We were all younger then.
Right.
A lot hairier.
And especially me.
And then so I came to Iowa, and then John came to Iowa, and then Larissa came to Iowa, John's wife. And then many, many, many decades went by.
And then we started the Delta Center.
And then John was the founding director of the Delta Center. And a small group of us built a pretty interesting group. And the Delta Center lives on, but John and Larissa sadly left for University of East Anglia. So wherever John and Larissa are, they are members of Delta Center.
And we're still part of the Delta Force.
The Delta Force, may the Force be with you. And still very much committed to the same basic ideas that we were trying to promote back in those days.
I think the big thing that stands out to me, the founding idea of the Delta Center was... and why we formed the center in the first place was that we never get together as scientists to talk about the big ideas of our science, right? We found that, like, you know, in psychology, we had a great developmental group, but we get together and we talk about, you know, Mark's work on sleep or, you know, my work on cognitive development or what Larissa was doing on word learning, whatever. It was all very focused on our research topics. And that's how we organized our scientific lives, but we never took a step back and said, what are the big pictures, ideas of our science? You know, how do we all relate? What are the big themes that organize what we do? Like, why do we do what we do? Why does it matter? All that stuff. And so that was really the founding idea of the Delta Center, was to get an interdisciplinary group together to talk about those big ideas.
And then we got together at Atlas and other places and started having discussions about a paper, and those discussions led to our first joint product, which was the
Short Arms
and Talking Eggs paper, which was published with some comments from other folks and a response from us, and has actually been read by quite a few people, and I think has been controversial in lots of places, but I think it sort of put our stamp on what our perspective was and what we were aiming to do with the center. But we have, of course, a project.
Mm-hmm.
we've done a variety of different things to try to promote developmental systems or dynamic systems perspectives out there.
Right.
Our personal current endeavor involves this collection of articles, about 25 articles that we've been preparing for.
For about 18 years,
yeah. Give or take 12. remember you and I were sitting in my office going like, should we do this? I don't know. Should we do this? I don't know. Should we do this? But you and I and
Dave, you weren't there. The answer was no. But we did it anyway.
So we, along with David,
but it's going to be awesome.
Yeah.
No. So like, I don't know. It's been about 6-7 years now that David Chang came out here. David Chang, a New York Times bestselling author. The Genius in All of Us.
Hi, David.
Books.
Hi, David. David will listen to a podcast like this.
Hey, David. and so the three of us embarked on this pretty ambitious project where we decided to try to present a developmental systems perspective to a broad audience, where we would try to invite some of our favorite writers, colleagues, and to develop their pieces in as much of a way as on the content side or the stylistic side, and present to the world, some different perspectives on these things.
So, I like the way David puts it, as sort of create the go-to site for developmental systems.
Yes, and I think it's a first. I think it's a great volume one. I'm sure there are volumes 2 and 3 in our future, should we decide to be suicidal, and. And it's become, I mean, it's almost done after these many years. Was it worth it? After all we've been through. We haven't talked about what we've been through. I mean, we've been through multiple publishers. We've been through years of delay. We've been through all kinds of ridiculous processes. But in the end,
it just makes us, and I'm speaking collectively as the readers of it, just want it more to hear you talk about it like
yes.
that, Mark.
Well, it's a product of labor of love, I guess.
Yeah.
So was it worth it, John? That's a good question.
I can't answer that. I think when we get across the finish line and see the whole finished product, and I think we're actually on a trajectory where it will come to fruition like I imagined, which is as a whole collection. So there's some discussion about that, but I think if we can launch it as a unified whole, all 25 essays together, linked together, nice production, then 6 months later you can ask me again, was it worth it, right? Because I think it certainly has the potential I saw in it when we started. We've had a lot more left turns than I anticipated, for sure. But I think it's still got a lot of potential. And if it is a go-to site for developmental systems, and I mean, I think one of the targets was to say, and this was really, again, coming from David Chang, was, he's like, there's no counterforce to the nature-nurture debate. No place for a journalist to go who says, oh, okay, I hear you saying it's not nature or nurture, and maybe it's not even both, which was our Short Arms perspective. It was like, we need to cast the whole framing aside, and this is a new framing.
Ditch the whole framework.
Yeah, well, so here's a question. Yeah, okay. So.
But the point was, this could be the site for that journalist to go to.
And it is going to be the site.
Yeah.
Here's the question. Well, there's going to be a question and then a more PC version of the question that follows. Why is this perspective better than other perspectives is the first question.
That was pretty PC.
Oh, that was PC? Oh, do you want to should I just go with that one then? Is that a...
Sure. Well, that was way too tame. I think you could have let go a little bit
more. Why is the other stuff... Is the non-VC. Okay. Yeah. So why is it... Why
and
is
this
it
question
a better
is to both of you. Yeah.
It's a better perspective because it's the scientifically tenable perspective. The facts are on our side. That's why it's the better perspective.
But that's what the other lunatics would say, too.
Actually, frankly, they don't. Well, certainly, they try. But, you know, at the end of the day, like, this was the point we made in our... I mean, it's pretty striking, like, to say to someone in developmental science that, you know, really, like, the nativist perspective, there's no evidence for it. I firmly believe that. There's no evidence. Like, if you seriously dig into all the things they would claim as evidence, like, it's on the shakiest ground ever.
So the fact that that stuff is there no, before there's...
Well, they talk about constraints, and they talk about predispositions, which predispositions exist in some one way or another in various systems. But the perspective I've always taken is that there has never, ever, that I have ever found in all the things that I've done or written, have I ever found any evidence that we are not better off asking the next question about where things come from. And the nativist perspective, fundamentally, the way I view it, puts a brake on the next level of questioning. Once you say that something is predetermined, pre-programmed in the genes, whatever the catchphrase is of the moment, all that serves to do is to blunt the desire to ask the next question. And there is not one example where somebody said, gee, I wonder where that comes from, and they were stunted. Like they didn't actually find something interesting about the origins of that particular thing. And so in our short arms paper that John and I and a bunch of other folks wrote, we said, stop talking about things before time T that you know nothing about. If you want to say that something exists at time T, whether it's day of birth or 3 months after birth or 5 months after, whatever, just say it. That's when you know it's there. But make no assumptions about how it got there, because we can point to plenty of examples where people have made the wrong inference.
This is important because on my computer, in the organization of all my papers, the short arms paper is still listed as the T-1 paper. Because that was the crux of the argument. That, you know, whatever, right? You as a scientist started studying it at 3 months. Or 2 months, or newborn, or the fetal period, whatever, you started somewhere. You can't, like, you can't study everything. You started somewhere, and that's T. So stop saying stupid about T-1. That was the basic crux of the argument.
The only reason
stop saying stupid about T-1.
Except for the fact that these folks are like rats pressing a lever, and they get massively reinforced
for T-1
arguments.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah. And as long as they get reinforced by those same editors.
Because it's the T-1 sexy. Arguments show up in the introduction and the discussion of your science paper.
Yes. Because the word, putting the word innate.
Because at the end of the day, stupid shit about infants looking is not like science worthy. I just killed the entire field of infancy, but
well, it's the lo and behold, you know,
but
look,
like
wow,
you know,
look
at the end
this.
Of the day, right? Yeah. It's important work, slavishly important work. I do it myself, right? But it's not gonna like, you know, in contrast to like the last 2 days, I've been at a grant meeting and like crazy shit about immunology and the microbiome and blood and blah, 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 right? And it's like crazy world out there, right? Infant looking is not, it's not science worthy.
You mean science magazine worthy,
yeah,
right?
Science magazine worthy. Still science worthy, yes. Yeah. Okay, we need to hit the pause button.
All right, so
John needs
a
refill.
There's a break. John needs a refill, yeah. And we'll be back in a little bit. Welcome back, Delta Cast. This is real fun. I hope you guys are having fun because I'm out.
You hear
fun.
The clicking? It's like a jazz club.
I do have to say that Mark Blumberg makes a mean Manhattan.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's good.
Yeah, well, you know, it takes
it rivals some of the best that I've had.
It does.
Anywhere.
It's the vermouth.
Yeah, it is the vermouth.
I know the vermouth.
Oh, it's that special vermouth.
I can't get that vermouth in England.
That's sad.
I might have to bring a bottle home with me.
It's Italian. You should be able to get it, and, you know.
I know.
So you,
in Italy, I can. Maybe I can in Norwich. I don't know. I would try.
Just swing by on your way back.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, swing by. Pick up a case.
Ish.
And maybe send a couple back to Iowa City.
That's right.
So this collection of essays sounds great.
Yes, Eric.
Right?
It does.
It does. We agree. Great.
I really wish really there was a collection of essays completed at this point.
We're almost there.
But you're almost there.
So close.
Yeah.
Yes.
But you're almost there.
So close.
Let me tell you. Okay, so here's why we need this collection of essays. One, because Mark and I work far too hard in our daily lives, and we've lost far too much sleep. So we just need them done. That's why we need this collection of essays. That's the first reason.
You guys deserve it.
We deserve it.
I know both of you kind of.
But the other reason...
And you deserve it.
...is everybody else deserves it too. Right.
It's a gift.
It's a gift. And here's where the gift is. Okay, so... So for the last few days, I've been at a grant meeting, okay?
So what's... Oh, yeah, yeah.
Okay, I've been at a grant meeting... Phenomenal work by my colleagues, mostly my colleagues. I haven't done that much, frankly, contributing to this grant. They say I do, but doesn't feel like I do. So a bunch of med docs, right, doing phenomenal work with preterm infants, okay? But the language that they have to talk about, like gender effects on sort of prematurity, and it's sort of prematurity and transfusion science and how the brain is affected by very sick babies having lots of blood transfusions, right? So real important stuff. I'm trying to influence clinical practice because one of the big decisions doctors have to make is when a baby's hematocrit is crashing, when do you intervene and transfuse new blood, right, to keep them alive, but because you don't know how far they're going to crash, right? And so... You know, life and death decisions on the line here, right? And what one of the results from the previous round of studies was a gender effect. Okay, so turns out females who get lots of transfusions have poor long-term outcomes, which is kind of counterintuitive because you'd think keeping their hematocrit, you know, up is a good thing and maybe a neuroprotective thing, but turns out for females it's a really bad thing. Right? It's kind of counterintuitive thing, and we're investigating that in this grant. But, you know, to talk about gender effects on the brain, you know, the language that's out there is, you know, gender is your sort of hardwired stuff, and because of the gender, you know, that's going to, like, propagate all this sequence of stuff in terms of brain development, and it's all biological and pre-tuned and hardwired or whatever. And... there's not a lot of thought that goes into statements like that. Because these are doctors making these statements, and they know full well that if it were a fixed hardwired system, right, prematurity wouldn't matter. The number of transfusions wouldn't matter. The inflammation response that happens in the brain because of those transfusions wouldn't matter. They know all this stuff matters and it's a flexible adaptive system and they're trying to study it to have an impact and promote better outcomes in these kids. But the language they use is gender, biological, hardwired. And that's just, I think that's a fault of sort of developmental systems and, you know, like how hard it is to grasp this idea that, you know, gender in the brain and the trajectory a kid's on isn't a hardwired thing. It's, you know, it's a pretty constrained thing, but it's like a step-by-step, you know, both biological and experiential process.
It's really interesting. I've been teaching a course to undergraduates, senior undergraduates, one of our senior seminars.
And remember, Mark has to teach because he's a full professor in the United States.
And I love it.
He's gonna.
I have a great class.
I wish I took a picture of that face.
Right? No. I'll be extremely obvious, extremely honest.
Yeah, it looked like you were really excited.
I love one thing I notice about you know, when I get released from teaching too long,
yeah,
that's fine. I get stale. I find that when I'm back in the classroom teaching, all the juices are flowing in ways that they just don't otherwise flow.
Right.
And I have a...
I expect to be dried up by next year.
and I'm so teaching a class on
developmental
systems.
It's giving that information. It's that exchange.
It's wonderful knowledge. You know, but you know, you're encountering a class of students who have all been indoctrinated in a variety of different things. And none of them has ever been introduced to anything like a developmental systems approach. Mm. I'm about midway through the semester here, maybe a little bit more than midway. And they're getting a little bit bored with all the examples I've given of things that violate their expectations of how they've been, you know, things that they've been taught. And it's really interesting because when you have the time to confront students with all the evidence of how processes play out in early development, they are overwhelmed and they acknowledge that how do you possibly, and they start to change. You can see them changing the way they think about development. You can see it. A lifetime of indoctrination folding under the weight of, you know,
data,
God forbid.
See, I told Darwin you we had data me. On our side.
Yeah. And it's an inspiring thing to watch. That's the greatest thing about teaching, is to see students, you know, revealing for themselves, you know, or testing themselves and thinking in new ways about things. And unfortunately, that doesn't, you know, the old saying about, you know, old scientists don't change their mind, they just die.
But see, this is where, I'm going to come back to David Shank, right?
Right.
And the challenge is you confront these kids with data, or I confront these med docs with data, right? But we need the metaphors, the language to clean up our act, right? And that's where it's been hard.
Right.
Right. So what do you say when you get a gender effect in terms of brain development? Do you say, you know, that's an experience thing, that's a biological thing? No, right? You have to somehow say that's a developmental thing, because that's really, at the end of the day, what it is. It's not a hardwired thing. It's a developmental thing. So developmental needs to become like the buzzword almost of, you know, instead of the nature-nurture thing, it's the developmental thing. That's really what it is. And that's the idea of a developmental system.
Right.
Right.
But, you know, it's funny how folks interpret the sorts of perspectives that we have, because I was at Genia Farm, a Howard Hughes, you know, thing, the Howard Hughes sponsored, you know, Genia Farm. And I was giving a talk there about developmental systems, the stuff we care about, the stuff the collection is about.
The Delta Cast.
Yes, the Delta Rock Cast. On. Delta Force.
Shannon and I just...
And I give this 30
have
minute.
Have you done the handshake?
Oh, no, don't do the handshake.
Yeah. No.
Plus, the who bought a podcast, a handshake means nothing.
It's really sad.
Don't even. Okay. Yeah. But the
Delta Force.
I'm going to take Mark's.
So I gave this, I forget a lot, 30 minute, 40 minute presentation of synopsis of this perspective. And this very prominent guy, very full of himself. I won't say what his name is.
Good, because you just named 1,000 scientists.
I just did. But a very arrogant, very pompous dude.
Oh, okay. So 999.
That's right. Should I give his name?
Yeah.
Yeah, he's a Caltech. Anyway, so he raises his hand at the end of this
Caltech,
thing, and he says,
I know a couple of people.
I think you're being called that. Right
no, yes.
No, it'll be edited. No. Put your hand over the microphone. No.
So he basically raises his hand and said, so what you're trying to tell us is that, so he's listening to me talking about, you know, a view of development that's interactive, that's talking about the inextricable relations between all sorts of factors in the developmental process. That instinct, which was the topic of this thing, is not something that you can easily, you know, reduce to a simple statement about it's hardwired or it's blueprinted or whatever buzzwords they want. And this person, this adult, this very smart, obviously adult, very prominent scientist, is only hearing one thing. But I can't possibly predict what it is that he's hearing. But what he hears is this, and this is the question he poses to me. He says, so what you're telling me is that genes are completely unimportant for any aspect.
Yeah, that's the, right.
And you said, yes, that is what I'm telling you.
Yeah, yeah. And you walked away. I'm done here.
No, I walked away. I said that is the most inaccurate caricature of anything that I could ever imagine saying. But how do you, so it's this nervous system problem where you're talking English and they're hearing it in French and they're completely misinterpreting what you're saying.
That's a very interesting problem because it happens all the time in the sense that you have never said that,
and would never say
that genes are unimportant. I find it funny.
I will say that.
John Spencer has just declared that genes don't matter.
Insanity, yeah.
All of you geneticists out there, you should open up a bowling alley.
I didn't believe it.
That statement is not endorsed by the Delta Center, nor does
or Delta Cast.
That's right.
But it is interesting how the assumption is. Yeah. That, oh, well, if someone is questioning the fact that genes are everything, then that has to mean that they believe that genes don't mean anything.
Well, for small minds that only think in terms of black and white, that's all there is.
Ouch.
Zing. Ouch.
No, we need another sound effect
for
that one.
Yeah. There's a wonderful paper by Tim Drotz about dichotomous thinking and developmental psychology. And dichotomous thinking is more than a problem for development. It's a problem for all aspects of science. Yeah. And we tend to try to put things into camps. And that is our problem. The problem fundamentally
is a threat.
It's a lot harder. It's a lot harder.
We have a threat bias.
Well,
that's some jargony term that I picked up.
There's always territorial. There's marking. There's plenty of marking going around. But I think the fundamental problem has to do with the fact that folks do not have easy language. We do not have a simple way of dealing with complexity. The vast middle of interactionism that is where most interesting scientific phenomena occur. And so we want to know how much of it is genetic and how much of it is environmental, how much of it is nature, how much is nurture, whatever our ridiculous concepts are that are driving our questions. And as long as that is our bias, we're doomed. We're going to be always having to cede control of our science to the people who are willing to make these ridiculously simplistic statements about complex phenomena.
Yeah.
So until we become a science.
Well, there is that too.
But there is a point there. So I think we do potentially like have to think about what I love about some of the newer genetic data is that we have to think about the time scale of genes in a fundamentally different way, right? So, you know, gene action these days is much more of a real time, maybe a learning time thing. And genes are actively engaged as we are actively engaged, actively starting to sculpt interactions in the brain, express new hormones and all sorts of crazy right, biologically that they do, but it's in the here and now, right? And that then can leave a trace that extends over longer timescales. But we used to think about genes over an evolutionary timescale. Genes are
part of the system
in the here and now, stretching over learning, stretching over weeks in development, right? Months in development. And that's a very different perspective or conceptualization of genes. They're just a different level in the system now that's all sort of step-by-step shaping itself as opposed to being this underlying constant that we got from evolution. And that's a very different framework for thinking about genes. And I think we will subvert the dominant paradigm when people who are doing really good developmental systems work, right, are embracing genes and the genetic level of analysis. And there are a lot of people who are doing that. But as it starts to filter in and this view starts to permeate and genes become part of our analysis on those more local timescales, I think that could be very powerful in overturning this sort of nature-nurture perspective because we start to think about genes in a very different way.
It's really interesting how this has all evolved because there have been people for decades making these arguments at a conceptual level, but it can't take off until there is the evidence for the geneticists to accept it. I mean, we live in a world where geneticists unfortunately have dominated the thinking. And so until geneticists come to terms with the fact that the Human Genome Project did not deliver in the way they thought it would deliver, Then they have to look to other things. Like, oh, you know, proteins, they matter too. Oh, boy, interactions. Oh, epigenetics. Oh, how genes are expressed. Oh, that matters too. It's as if we have to get the geneticist to appreciate the things that folks have been talking about for decades as obvious logical flaws in the way they were thinking about it. So the historical record is going to be messy. It's going to feel inconclusive. But folks have been seeing the problems with these dichotomous ways of thinking for a long, long period of time.
That's because the geneticists are sort of looked at as the
gods of biology.
Top echelon of
we live biology. In a hierarchical world.
Right. Yeah, right.
Yes, genes are the professors.
I know.
Man. In the English sense of academia.
Yeah.
I was going to.
Yes, you like that?
And I tell you what, those genes, they only give 3 lectures a year.
That's right.
Genes are important. That should be like a t-shirt or something, right? Working as a clinician with people who stutter, and being a person who stutters myself, who has family history of stuttering, you know that there's a very, very good chance people in the family line, in the genetic line, also stutter. You know, the fact of the matter is that there certainly is, Mark was saying before, there's strong predisposition to it. You know, there's no doubt about it. You know, some people are predisposed to experience stuttering. Yeah.
All other things being equal, any predisposition has to involve also a developmental process. But
yes.
But what you're saying is that's right. So under normal developmental conditions, people in your family might end up being stuttered. People in my family might end up having OCD.
Yeah.
Under the same exact conditions.
And, you know. And I get the Alzheimer's lottery.
Aren't we all winners? Yeah.
Choose your
choose your place.
Choose your place.
I mean that's you know,
I know I don't have anything
as
more
a first, like as a first step. Imagine a world where we thought about those predispositions as just developmental predispositions instead of genetic predispositions.
Just because of the connotation with genetics or something else?
Yeah, like, in the spirit of the special issue or special collection we're putting together, right? In the spirit of trying to change, you know, I go back to the story about the grant meeting, right? That I think if these med docs thought about, you know, what they're saying, they wouldn't say hardwired. Because again, if it was hardwired, then everything they're doing shouldn't matter, right? All the insults and prematurity shouldn't matter. Because those are, at the end of the day, you know, external contingencies impinging on the organism that are having a profound effect, right? So it's not environment versus biology, it's development. So what if we replaced, you know, you have a family history of stuttering with in your family, there's a developmental predisposition for stuttering. Would that change how we think about that? I kind of think maybe it would, because then it, like you say, developmental predisposition, that means there's something in the developmental history, biologically or experientially, or probably both, of course, that's what we're talking about, that sets the stages for something to happen.
Would you say you're given the template to stutter, or would you say that you're given a malleable template?
Well, it's almost like it's not a template, I would say, because that's like connotes fixed, right? It's more that so it's like left to its own devices, this is a viable outcome.
Not right? Determined outcome.
Not a determined outcome, but a viable outcome.
Likely outcome?
You who can knows? Say, yeah, who knows?
Data. Okay. Data.
We don't know that. I mean,
data answer
that
question.
You got,
and you might say
siblings,
genetic,
right?
But, you know, there are other factors that are passed down. I mean, within, you know, I'll go back to that Genia Farm, you know, thing where we were hanging out at a bar, and this guy who had invited me was saying, like, you know, how do you get around the fact that instincts are genetically determined, they're passed down, blah, blah, blah. And I said, well, what about Jurassic Park? And he said, well, what about Jurassic Park? I said, do you know why Jurassic Park can never occur? And he said, well, what do you mean? I said, well, the reason why you can never simply take the DNA of a dino and recreate it is because you don't have access to the egg. And what eggs possess is a cytoplasm. And that cytoplasm contains determinants, molecular products that are as species typical as the DNA itself. And the yolk of an egg, which we think is just the white stuff that we eat for breakfast, actually contains a lot of stuff that makes species typical genetic activity possible. And I can tell you that he's jaw dropped. He had never thought of that. And he went through this period. I could see, you know, this revelatory moment where he just sort of went, oh my God, it's not just all about the genes. And that's the thing. You know, there are many features to inheritance. We inherit genes. We inherit mitochondrial DNA from our mothers. We inherit the cytoplasmic determinants. That is, the yolk of the egg determines much of what we have. We have placental differences. And we have all kinds of experiential differences that have to do with our families and how we treat each other and things like that. All of these things are in a mix. And to presume that because we have some kind of a thing that runs in a family, therefore it must accord to some predisposed idea. That's the idea that's predisposed. That's where we go wrong. And we have to entertain all of the known factors of development. As John was saying, it's a developmental process. So we have to think about all the things in development that contribute to giving rise to these familial processes. And to not do that is to do a disservice to the science as well as doing disservice to each other. Because if our goal is to identify and potentially intervene, we have to know how the whole thing works.
Well, that's the other bit, right? That always gets my goat, like the intervention side, right? It's like, if you want to intervene, you better put your bets down on the developmental predisposition idea than the genetic predisposition idea. Right, because if it's a developmental predisposition, you've got an entire arsenal at your disposal for how you can have systematic influences to change the outcome. That's much more hopeful, right? But if you are a genetic predisposition, then you've got like gene therapy.
Which has yet to occur,
right? So just changing that one little word may be the lever to change an entire mindset about how people think about development.
And there's a real phenomenon that people talk about, which is called interchangeability of developmental effects, that genes and environment are interchangeable. And they are interchangeable in the sense that if you just take a simple example of sex development of sexual development, that doesn't make sense. Yeah. In terms of the development of males and females. No. Yeah. I mean, in the case of mammals, we have chromosomes that we have X and Y sex chromosomes, but turtles don't have X and Y sex chromosomes. They have temperature playing the role of those chromosomes. So high temperatures lead males and low temperatures lead to females or vice versa. It doesn't matter. The thing is that you can have temperature effects or chromosomal effects, and that gets back to the point that genes and chromosomes are only part of the system. They are part of a mechanism for creating developmental change. And as long as we think about them as part of the system and not as pre-programmed determinants of our outcomes, of our lives and whatever, then we're talking as biologists and not as fantasists.
There's also a social aspect that, for example, in my field, in stuttering, to know that there's a gene that's common across some people who stutter actually makes a lot of people who stutter feel better about the fact that they have this thing that's unexplained and in some instances they're helpless and they can't do anything about it. So there's a whole other sort of side to this that I think I just brought up. I didn't want to bring it up.
No, it's
because I wanted to talk about it in another show. I think it's a good.
Yeah, that's a great. Yeah. I encountered something like that, but in a different domain. It was actually, I was.
I encountered something like that, but in the exact opposite sense.
But I was invited to
where my aging physiology is letting me down.
No, it wasn't like that. Oh, no, I was it had to do with the origins of being gay, and I was at this secular humanist club, and I had been invited to talk to them, and I had just finished a book talking about the origins of instincts and things like that, and they were interested in that topic, and so I was asked the question, well, was there a gene for being gay? And I said no. Now in those days, probably still today, if you say something like that, then you could be easily accused because of our dichotomous perspective. Oh, if you don't think there's a gene for it, then you must be saying it's a choice, and therefore, right. You know,
exactly.
And I would say it's not genetic, and it's not a choice.
Yeah,
and that is the middle. That is the horrible, real middle of this sort of thing. Is that for most of the complex behaviors, orientations, whatever you want to call them, the thing is that there is. It's not a simple case that there's a gene for it, and it's not the simple case that it's a choice. It's that it develops. Exactly what John said before. It develops.
Now there's your T-shirt. It's not genetic. It's not a choice.
And it was really,
taking some of that.
It was really interesting. Let me just say one thing. To finish the story, because the person who had invited me was himself gay, and so his initial response, I could see him bristle when I said that I didn't think there was a gene for it. But then when I explained myself and said, I also don't think it's a choice. I think it develops. And by the time you're born or early development, you're on a developmental path, and it is no longer something that you're choosing. He was visibly relieved that I was not his enemy, while not giving him the answer that he had thought was the only one that he could live with.
But that's the thing, is that there's this issue of fault. It feels much better for people who are going through something tough or who are struggling with something to hear the fact that, oh, well, you were put in this position. You could do something, you know, to try to help yourself out, to manage it, to do it. But it allows them to feel better when there's something in there that says, no, it's not your fault. You were given a predisposition to you know, be gay or to stutter or to, you know,
be Jewish.
Be a Jew from the East Coast. No. So, you know, at the end of the day, it makes it easier clinically to sort of learn to manage it when it's not like you did something to make this happen.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, that's a sad, scary thing, right?
Yeah.
Because that means that the politics are driving the science and not the other way around. And at some level, I guess I just, as a non-clinician, oh boy.
But as a person.
As a person, I am not interested in what making people feel better. As a scientist, it's like, it's not about making people feel better. It's about making them feel okay about reality.
Yeah,
the reality is not as bad as what people think it is.
Yeah, but allow me to reframe what you just said.
Please do, because I'm sure I just, you know, pissed a whole lot of people off. You know?
Because there's strength in objectivity, being able to be objective about your situation. You know, that's going to help you do something about it.
Well, or, you know, it may be if it's a developmental predisposition, you know, like it's not all about you, right? And that's where the two perspectives may meet. So saying developmental predisposition at some level, you know, yeah, you can view that as it's a little bit beyond my control, right? There's a trajectory there that before anyone was even aware of it, you were on that trajectory, and, you know, that's the way it is. But at the same time, if we can understand that trajectory, right, that may mean that the next Eric that comes along may not have the same struggles. May have different struggles, of course, because we can't control everything.
I mean, there are lots of them.
Stuttering may be okay, right? You know, and so that, in that sense, I think that's where the hopeful bit comes in. Like, you know, the two perspectives align. Yeah, it is damn hard to change the trajectory of development. We all know that. And it's not because of genes or because of experience. It's because of the way they are seamlessly intertwined and the step-by-step T minus one to T plus one effects that happen, right?
And different for everybody.
And different for everybody. But if we can understand how the system works, then it may be possible, especially with early intervention, to steer that trajectory in a different course very early and maybe, you know, limit the number of cases where that developmental predisposition comes to fruition.
But I think all this whole conversation only highlights why people think that studying genes are so much more likely to be more fruitful, because it seems to be more manageable, right?
But it's crazy.
It's an illusion.
It's an illusion.
It's an illusion of control. But in the world of mice, it's a very powerful illusion of control. And so we're living in a strange world right now. I mean, if you look at the autism world, you know, it's looking like dozens, perhaps many more than dozens of genes are contributing to autism. You know, the same thing for schizophrenia. The data are pushing folks into a direction where they have to deal with the complexity.
Sounds like it's going to be great.
It's going to be great.
You guys want to tell us a little bit about what's going to be in the collection?
No.
It's a secret.
You've been listening to...
No. Tell us about the collection, John.
So the collection, you know, if you're thinking about a developmental systems perspective, one of the big counterforces we have to address is the level of genes, right? So how do we think about, how we think about genes, how we think about genes in the context of evolution, how we think about genes in the context of development. So that's a section. Okay. So really updating the view of genetic effects in development. I think the second level you have to target from a developmental systems perspective, right, is...
My hands are talking.
Essentially, the place where genes and behavior meet, which is the brain, right? So there's a section on neural development, how that happens, and how it is a product of development. And then the third place we go is behavioral development, expertise, bringing in some of the stuff that is, really David Shank's forte. Talking about expertise, behavioral development, essentially, intelligence, sort of the developmental trajectory that happens. Kind of, the other stuff sort of is very heavy in early development, right? Because genetic expression, brain development, all that stuff, a lot of the work on that front is very early, although actually interestingly, some of the newer stuff in brain development with neuroimaging extends into, deep into postnatal life. But, the behavioral stuff is really, I think, the forte of, you're born, happens, development happens, right? And that's where expertise, learning develops.
See, yeah. Your t-shirt is development happens.
Yeah, development happens.
And it's a really wonderfully diverse group of people too. I mean, we have a knight. We have a sir.
This is one of the few collections with
that
a sir.
That has a sir.
It didn't happen at night. There's an actual knight.
Seriously. Seriously.
Because
professor in the UK. Yeah. That's good.
Yeah. Knight.
Sir.
Knight. Yes.
Knight.
Sir.
We have
a sir. Sir Patrick.
Yeah.
And we have, it's a really a wonderful collection of folks. And I would say that in all fairness, I mean, not everybody that we invited would necessarily embrace everything that we say. Hmm. But I think that the work that they've done, the perspectives they hold, fit very nicely within what it is.
Fortunately, we're the editors.
Yes.
Even if they don't embrace what we say, they have to say what we want them to say.
We are the knights of our own collection.
But that shows that it was a very inclusive effort, you know, fact that that's the case. I think folks would say
we weren't inclusive enough. And that'll be a criticism that we'll have to deal with, is that folks will say that, oh my God, you didn't include so-and-so.
Famous person X.
Yes. And you know what? We didn't include...
You should have had two nights instead of one.
But we tried to make it diverse. And of course, you know, the thing evolved over time. And I think it's turned into a really interesting collection. I hope it sets a standard for these sorts of things in the future. But only time will tell if we've been successful. But you know, these are risky, risky things. John and I sat in my office 6 years ago. We looked at each other and said, are we sure we want to do this?
I don't remember that at all, but
you don't remember that?
No.
It's one of the few things I remember from 6 years ago. I did. You don't remember that?
No, I don't.
That moment where we said, like, are you sure? And it was a labor of massive dislike, because we had to deal with like multiple
Mr.
publishers. I mean, this thing was like,
no, but that's going to be amazing.
This was an extremely difficult birth. Not that I would know anything about anything.
Well,
about
and
that.
It's extremely difficult in some of the ways we were talking about earlier about, you know, when you try to do something like this, there is a system and a structure in science. And, you know, the system and structure in science is lauded in many respects and peer review and blah, blah, blah. But it's also can be a hindrance to new perspectives in a lot of ways, too. And so the fact that this collection cuts across disciplines, right, from really, you know, more biological side, neuroscience side, behavioral side, right, that made it very challenging. Fortunately, we had people step by step who I think were on our side, and we've stumbled in our way a little bit in the dark and found people who were very receptive. It has been a torturous enterprise, and we've had to deal with some roadblocks thrown up. But
yeah, so
I think
challenging in the sense that it was like people from different backgrounds or people who use different approaches, or...
No, because I think what we assembled is a group of people who have a largely coherent view, and in some cases, as Mark said, needed a little push to express it in a way that's consistent with other people. And that's just, in some ways, a language thing. I think it's more... some of the obstacles were about... how, you know, when you try to do something new that has a strong scientific background but is in some ways against the current views in the literature, then the easy obstacles to throw up are like peer review and, this isn't done in a scholarly way. I mean, that's another thing, is it's a little bit of a moving target for our authors, because we started off really trying to push the general science audience perspective. And so some of the authors started with a perspective that wasn't heavy on citation and wasn't, you know, going into meticulous detail to defend an argument. It was trying to convey an argument to a general audience. But then when that essay gets held up to a scientific standard, right, you say, well, there were the citations, and you haven't discussed this evidence and that evidence that are, you know, this is counter going against the dominant perspective. So it's like, then we had to like retreat a little bit and say, okay, now what they want is, instead of conveying a developmental systems perspective coherently to a general audience, do that, because that's what we want. But you also have to have the citations and the evidence to satisfy these people who don't think your argument is the right one, because they've bought into the sort of dominant paradigm, right? And so it's been a little bit of a challenge to navigate that whole territory of, we're trying to do something that presents a coherent perspective to in a way that people will understand. Right. So again, that journalist who writes the article in the New York Times about genes effects on X, actually has a counter source to go to say, you know, it may not be all genetic, it may be a developmental thing, right? So they have a go-to place, but at the same time, we have to satisfy all the scientists who aren't necessarily up to speed on some of the things we think are the most compelling data.
Awesome.
Fine. Yeah.
No, it's I'm really
that's
looking
why it
for
took 6 years instead of two.
Well, and then there were multiple publishers. Anyway, it's been a long,
I'm looking,
delightful process.
I'm looking forward to it being out so
as
I can read it. Yeah.
Mm.
I'm sure you guys are. So you could do other, add other stuff onto your plate.
Right.
All right. So that was a marathon.
Marathon
show.
Yeah. Sets a standard.
You guys are the best. Mark Blumberg, John Spencer, you guys are awesome. I'm Eric Jackson. See you next time.
DeltaCast.
All right. DeltaCast is a production of the Delta Center at the University of Iowa.
The Delta Center is funded by the Department of Psychological and Brain Sciences, the Department of Communication Sciences and Disorders, the College of Education, the Office of the Vice President for Research, the College of Liberal Arts and Sciences, and the Obermann Center. All of the wonderful music you heard during today's podcast was written by my good friend Josh Kaufman. Thank you, Josh.
You can learn more about the Delta Center by going to www.deltacenter.uiowa.edu, and you can also follow us on Facebook.